You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In the mid-90s, my guest today was already a well-known award-winning sports writer and a frequent guest on ESPN, the result of his singular focus on his career, often to the exclusion of his personal relationships, family, and everything else. But all that changed when he decided to reconnect with his old college professor, Maury Schwartz. Schwartz was suffering a slow, painful death, his body ravaged by ALS. But in his final months, he took it upon himself to share some hard-earned wisdom with his former student about life, family, and the things that truly matter. Mitch Albom took those conversations with his mentor and put them into a little book called Tuesdays with Maury. Tuesdays with Maury would go on to become the all-time best-selling memoir and launch a new chapter in Mitch's life as the inspirational writer behind six number one bestsellers that have sold over 35 million copies around the world. But more importantly, his time with Maury inspired him to radically change his life, prioritizing his loved ones over his work, forming deeper relationships with those he cares about, giving back through his various charities, and inspiring others through his meaningful and often spiritual novels that address the most important subjects in life, such as loss, purpose, forgiveness, and family. Now his latest book is a follow-up to his number one bestseller, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. Titled The Next Person You Meet in Heaven, it tells the story of a young woman whose life is cut tragically short the morning after her wedding. Today, Mitch Albom joins me on the podcast to talk about how losing his adopted daughter to cancer inspired this latest work, what the book has to say about mistakes and forgiveness, and how his favorite uncle inspired one of his most beloved characters, who makes a return in The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. He reveals how difficult it was to get Tuesdays with Maury published, some of the lessons from Maury Schwartz that have come to mean more to him 20 years later, and what Maury, who preached, "Don't buy into the culture," would think about our social media-obsessed society. Plus, how Mitch came to care for an entire orphanage in Haiti, the band he formed with Stephen King and other famous writers, and the five people Mitch would like to meet in heaven. Coming up with best-selling author and all-around good guy, Mitch Albom, in just a moment. Mitch Albom is a best-selling author, screenwriter, playwright, and nationally syndicated columnist. The author of six consecutive number one New York Times bestsellers, including Tuesdays with Morrie, the best-selling memoir of all time. His books have collectively sold more than 35 million copies in 42 languages. Now he's written a follow-up to his 2003 bestseller, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. It's called The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. Mitch Albom, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, although I have to admit that I didn't quite finish it. And I'm all the more ashamed of that because, you know, it's not exactly like homework. Your books are relatively short and quite pleasurable, but I think I probably did you a favor because I am notorious for spoilers. I always give away the ending to a guest movie or whatever book they're promoting, or I reveal the secret twist in the season finale of a TV show. Yeah. So I think that it's a good thing. I think
yes,
I did you a little bit of a favor probably
one
in
of
the
those,
end.
This does have one of those endings that hopefully you don't see coming. So I'm not going to ruin it for you either.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to finishing it.
Thank you.
Now, you didn't start out wanting to be a writer, right? Didn't
no.
you want to be a musician at
yes.
first?
Yes. I not only wanted to be, I was.
Yeah. For how many years were you doing the music then?
Well, I played music all through high school and college. I planned on being a musician after college, so I helped pay for my tuition as a working musician while I was in college. I never wrote anything in college. I never wrote for my college newspaper or anything like that, the typical routines that journalists and authors yeah. will tell you about. And then I went over to Europe and I lived there for a little while. I was a piano player and a singer on the island of Crete for a short period of time, believe it or not.
How romantic is that?
Really.
That
how crazy
like
I was
right
to
there.
Leave it. Yeah, mm-hmm. And came back. And then I was in New York, did the whole starving musician playing coffee houses and rock clubs and, you know, Monday night showcases and things like that and producing songs. This was in the early 80s. And eventually, I just kind of realized that I loved music. I was passionate about music. I still am. But sometimes, you know, your avocation and your vocation shouldn't necessarily be the same thing.
Yeah.
And I was starting to lose my love for music because of the business of music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of shifted over to something that I said, well, I know I want to do something creative. I'm not interested in an office job or any kind of, you know, thing where you have to be behind a desk. And I just found that I volunteered for a local newspaper, and I found that I had some aptitude in writing. I found that it was very much like music to me anyhow. And I've been in it ever since.
Now, do you still play?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
But for fun, you know,
play for fun. I play with a band.
I
play with a band called the Rock Bottom Remainders,
yeah.
which is definitely for fun. Stephen King and Dave Barry and Amy Tan and Scott Turow and Ridley Pearson and many, many other authors. We've known each other, played together for, gosh, like 25 years, maybe more. And we play once a year. We go out for charity and we raise money
really?
For literacy. And we're a terrible band for the most part, but a handful of us,
yeah.
you know, used to actually be musicians.
All authors, that's funny.
All authors, yeah.
What does Stephen King play?
Guitar.
Yeah?
He has a spider fretted guitar, and Stephen's not a natural born guitar player. He's learned, but periodically, you know, if he doesn't know a chord, we'll just point to it and he'll say, oh, that spider.
Yeah.
Oh, that spider. Okay, I got it.
Now, you're an interesting case because so many people know you from Tuesdays with Morrie and your other books, like The Five People You Meet in Heaven. But prior to that, and even still today, I mean, you had this amazing career as, I think, one of the most award-winning sports writers. What, you won like 13 Associated Press Sports Editors Awards and all kinds of other awards. You're in the National Sports Media Hall of Fame. So you were already pretty well known as a sports writer when yeah. Tuesdays with Morrie and this whole other opportunity came along.
Yeah. Well, I think in some ways, that's why people who have read my work or who've said they've enjoyed it do so because, you know, I didn't set out to be some kind of self-help writer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of myself as one today. I didn't set out to be some kind of spiritual writer, inspirational writer, you know, but I have to say that that's where a lot of my interests now lie. But, you know, I was forged in writing and sports writing. I still love sports. But I think a lot of people, they look at me as kind of an unlikely source for this type of book, you know, The Five People You Meet in Heaven, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven, Tuesdays with Morrie. That's coming from a sports writer, you know, and I heard that when I was writing them.
Sure.
I mean, Tuesdays with Morrie, you know, it's, I heard you say in the introduction that it's the most successful memoir of all time, and I always laugh because I remember trying to get that book published, and nobody wanted it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they said to me, and I was only trying to pay my old professor's medical bills. I mean, that wasn't supposed to be any kind of big book. I was just trying to get enough money to cover his bills. And one publisher after another said, no, boring, depressing. Besides, you're a sports writer. Who wants to read a sports writer's take on what's meaningful in life? I mean, I heard that all the time. So I always laugh at it now because, you know, now it became what it did. And I think that whole thing about, well, I've had another life. I still have another life. I don't walk around in a shroud. I'm not here to sell you on religion. Yeah. I'm just a person who was very blessed to, at right at the height of his sort of young career arc in my mid-30s, I had a real life-changing experience. Yeah. I spent, you know, about the better part of 6 months every Tuesday with an old dying professor who really got to me and opened my eyes about what's important in life and what isn't, and this path that I was on of go, 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 and earn, and achieve, achieve, achieve. And then, as a result, I wrote a book to pay his medical bills. The book became this big thing, and now the book has kind of taken me where it wanted to go, and I don't really have control of my life that way.
Did you ever envision yourself writing things other than sports writing?
Nope.
Maybe writing a novel or something?
I thought maybe
sports biography.
Maybe one day. Well, I wrote sports biographies. I wrote a book about Bo Schembechler. It was a bestseller on the New York Times list. I wrote a book called Fab Five, which was also a bestseller. And so I thought, well, okay, I guess this is what I'll do. You know, I'll write sports. I'll comment on sports. I was on ESPN. Still, you know, do things with ESPN. I was on radio. Sure. And I thought, just be immersed in the sports world. Maybe one day I'll write a sports novel. I don't know. So when I wrote Tuesdays with Morrie, it was just a detour off the highway and then coming back. And I remember distinctly saying to my literary agent when they printed it, they printed 20,000 copies total for
that's
the whole country.
That's not a big order, is it?
That's not a lot of copies of a book considering how big the country is. You do the math, it's about, you know, 400 copies a state or something like that. So I remember saying to him, hey, do you think that this is going to hurt my sports writing? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, it's kind of a sentimental, soft book. It's emotional. It's open, you know, it's inspirational. Do you think, like, I'm going to walk into locker rooms now and the athletes are going to point at me and say, oh, I read that book. You were crying at the end like a baby.
It's not macho in the traditional
not
sense.
Not at all. And I remember he laughed. He said, I wouldn't worry about it. Nobody's going to read it. You know? And that was my literary agent. So, you know, that's what I thought. I thought I just would return to that life. But as I said to you a couple minutes ago, it took me over and it has led me to a far richer life and a far more, I think, significant one in exploring some of these other themes and getting a chance to do in a lot of charities and things like that, the things that I never would have done if I hadn't kind of gotten off the road for Tuesdays with Morrie.
I want to talk about the impetus for you getting reacquainted with your former college professor, Morrie Schwartz. He gave an interview to Ted Koppel on ABC Nightline. Were you like, what is Coach Morrie doing on Nightline?
Yeah,
did that happen?
Well, he and I had been extremely close in college. I mean, extremely close. I took every class that he offered. I majored in sociology, really just because of him. And, you know, we used to walk around campus together. We'd have lunch together. You know, I gave him a briefcase when I graduated. He started to cry, gave me a big hug. He said, you know, you're one of the good ones, Mitch. Promise me you'll stay in touch. And I said, I will. And he said, promise. And I said, I will. He said, say it in a sentence. Say it in a sentence. Okay, I promise I'll stay in touch.
So he was kind of like your Mr. Chips, your Mr.
Yes.
Holland.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And then I broke that promise for 16 straight years because I was so ambitious and so interested in pursuing my own thing. And, you know, first as a musician and then as a writer. And I just forgot about him. I mean, I knew he was there, but I just figured he'd always be there. And then one night, as you point out, 16 years later, I happened to be flipping the TV channels. And there he was talking to Ted Koppel about what it was like to die from Lou Gehrig's disease. I saw his face. I saw he was a withered, white-haired version of himself. And something compelled me to call him up, which I thought would be a one-time phone call. And then by the time I finished that phone call, he had convinced me to come see him. So I went to go see him in what I thought would be a one-time visit.
Yeah. Did he guilt you much?
He, in his own way.
Yeah.
I mean, not in an overt way, like, you know, where have you been all this time? Nothing like that. Just, you know, boy, it's good to see you again. And, you know, how have you been? And he never asked me anything about how much money I earned. He couldn't care less that I was on ESPN or sports or anything. He was asking me things like, are you happy with your life? Have you found someone to share your life with? Are you involved in your community? You know, things like this. And I began to go back the following Tuesday, and what turned out to be all the Tuesdays that he had left in his life. Selfishly, I guess, to get the answer to the question, you know, what did he clearly know now that he was dying? And there was no question that he was dying, that put life in perspective. And wouldn't it be great to know that when you were young enough and healthy enough to do something about it?
I wonder, are there lessons that may not have meant as much to you when you were that age, but now, what, 21, 20 years later, maybe they make more sense to you, or they resonate a lot more?
That's a really interesting and good question. Because people always ask me about Tuesdays and Maury, you know, what was your favorite Tuesday? Or what was the thing? But they don't say, well, it's been 20 years. Is there one now that resonates more, like you just asked me? So, yes.
And now you're closer to his age than you were to...
Way closer, yeah. So. Yeah, there are several. One has to do with forgiveness. Mm-hmm. I don't think I really understood that lesson when I was younger, because I hadn't had a lifetime to hold grudges about people, with people or stuff. I hadn't lived that long. And now I see how important that is, having lost so many people, how important it is to say you're sorry over whatever it is that might be rubbing you the wrong way or keeping you apart. That was certainly one. Don't buy the culture. If you don't like it, don't buy the culture.
Yeah.
You know, I was so into the culture. As I was in the midst of the culture. I mean, if you're in sports and you're on television and you're writing in a daily column, and, you know, how much deeper in the culture, the American hysteria over sports. And now, of course, and especially with today, with everything that is so, you know, you're so immersed, you have to be like all in for something, and you got to get with movements, and you got to get...
What do you think that Maury would think about, you know, the social media-obsessed reality TV narcissistic culture today? I mean, this is nothing like what it was when you were talking with him in the 90s. What would he make of that?
He would say, throw out your devices. No question. He was a bit of an anarchist anyhow, but, you know, and he would say, you know, he was saying, shut off your television sets. That was back then. And those were when you had to actually turn on a television set. Yeah. They didn't, like, you couldn't clap your hands and it went on. So I'm sure he would say, throw out your devices. Mm-hmm. Stop talking to one another through. Well, here's a story that would have broken Maury's heart. My nephew, teenage nephew, a few years ago, went to a prom. It was the first day. He lived overseas, so he'd never known what a prom was. And when he got back, I said, how was it? And he said, well, it was okay, but everybody was kind of, you know, on their devices, you know, talking to people. I said, well, yeah, that's kind of how we do it over here. Everybody's on their devices, probably telling their friends back home, you know, look at what's going on. He says, no, they were talking to one another on their device. The same people
at the table
were texting each other saying, you know, look at this guy or look at this outfit. That would have broken Maury's heart, because Maury was so much about being present. Yeah. Present, looking you in the eye. And of course, when he had ALS, you know, he could only look one way. His head couldn't turn. He couldn't, you can't move a muscle. So that would have really broken his heart. And I remember that very much. Don't buy the culture if you don't think it's right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's right. And I am not a big texter or tweeter or anything. I have all those things as any author today. We'll have some, and you're supposed to have some kind of presence on it, but it's much more begrudging professional obligation than it is the need to be heard all the time. Well, you're much younger, so I don't know. Good for you for having that, because you're resisting a bigger generational pull than I am.
Yeah, well, I think also it's part of its laziness. I don't admire the people who feel that they have to feed that beast all day long, every day, and on their weekend they have to, you know, put up photos of their vacation and their personal time.
And their meals.
Whoever is out there listening
and
watching.
That's not me. That wasn't him. So that one. And lastly, the family. Mm-hmm. I have been late in coming to family of my own in terms of children. My wife and I got married fairly late, and I delayed probably having children a little too long because I was too interested in my professional development. And by the time we were, you know, really on the same page, we weren't able to make it happen. But I have gotten involved over the last decade in Haiti. I just kind of by accident, I ended up taking over an orphanage.
Yeah.
In one of those moments where I don't know what I was thinking, but I was like, how hard could it be? I'll just run the orphanage. And, you know, I'm there every month, and I have 47 children that I really consider my kids.
That's amazing.
And, you know, we're raising them. Two of them now are here in college, for our oldest two, and the youngest one is 3.5. And so I have learned what he said, that there is no security, there is no foundation of love like the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those words didn't mean to me at 37 what they mean to me now.
And now you got a big family.
I got a big family, yeah.
That's incredible. When you took that on, what was that like? I mean, you didn't know anything, I'm assuming, about running an orphanage.
I just thought, you know, I'd run charities, and I thought, well, charity, orphanage, and... You learn very, very quickly. Like, I remember the first time I was down there after sort of agreeing, okay, I'll take it over. And there were people wondering, how do you take over an orphanage? The man who had started it was in his mid-80s. He didn't have any money. He wasn't in particularly good health. He was an American. And he asked me to, you know, and I said, well, I could do it. And he said, hallelujah, praise Jesus, here you go. And that was it. So suddenly I was there, and I remember walking around through the door in the bedrooms for the kids, and I'm going, what is that smell? Why does it smell so bad in here? And the nannies were laughing in Haitian. They were whispering in Creole. And I said, why are you laughing? And they said, pee, 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 acabon, which means they pee the bed. Don't you understand that the kids pee the bed? And I had to learn that I had gotten all new mattresses like an idiot and didn't protect the mattresses. Of course, once a kid pees in a bed, the mattress is kind of ruined. And so, you know, that was my first dumb, stupid American lesson, you know, and although American or otherwise, a kid pees a bed, he pees a bed. So now we use a lot of air mattresses for all new kids, and we have these mattress protectors. And, you know, I've learned my lesson the hard way. Everything from that to stairs that are slippery, to kinds of sandals the kids have on, to inoculations, to fungal creams, to, you know, kid can't touch this kid if he's going to be sick like that, or, you know, how you group them together, to the buddy system when we take them out on buses, to all that kinds of stuff that
quite
you just learn.
Curve.
Yeah, you learn by experience. I'm there every month. So, you know, 3 or 4 days every month, I'm getting this harsh education. And I'm fairly good at, like, corralling 47 kids, and come on, let's all go do something. But it's a learned experience for sure.
Has this orphanage influenced your writing?
Yeah.
Really?
Most definitely. Especially with this new book, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. If you read it all the way through, you'll see.
Which I promise I will. I'm looking forward to it.
The main character, Annie, who was the little girl, for those people who read The Five People You Meet in Heaven, remember that, and it was made into a movie. The premise of that is there's an old amusement park worker, 83-year-old guy named Eddie, who thinks his life doesn't matter. He's a nobody. He's a nothing. He's just waiting to die. And he, on his 83rd birthday, does die trying to save a little 8-year-old girl from an accident in a park, one of these tower drops, and the cart snaps off and drops. It plummets to earth. He sees this little girl's on the base. She crawled onto the base, and he goes to push her out of the way. He feels her two little hands in his hands, and then everything goes black, and he dies, and it turns out he's crushed by this cart. He goes to heaven. He meets five people from his life, which is, he finds out, is the first stage of heaven for everybody. We meet five people from our life.
By the way, can I stop you there? Why are there five? I actually read the book, but I'm trying to remember if this gets explained in the
book.
No,
it doesn't. You're not the first person to ask. And I don't have any magical. People have gone, the penta, something. No, I can tell you honestly, I had my hand down when I was looking, and I looked at my five fingers, and I said, five, that's a good number, and that was basically it.
Okay.
It could have been the seven people you meet in heaven, but that's kind of long. Three people you meet in heaven doesn't give you enough.
Okay. You must get all kinds of fan theories and conspiracies, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a whole... You go on the internet, there's a lot of fan fiction, am I saying
right? Yeah.
Where people have rewritten, you know, new characters that Eddie met in heaven, and
really?
Thousands of them. Oh, wow. Yeah, I can't keep up. But yes, there's theories. But that's the only theory, the true theory.
Okay.
So anyhow, he meets these five people, and he finds out by the end of his life that his life was actually very significant, and it had touched all kinds of people in all kinds of ways, because the five people you meet are not necessarily people you know. Some of whom could be someone you had a five-second encounter with. You know, you veered your car, they veered, you veered, you missed hitting them, they missed, and they went on to live, or somebody died or something like that. So this book, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven, picks up years later when Annie, the little girl he saved, is now grown. And she does not remember the incident because it was traumatic, and she had actually, she lost her hand in the incident. They had to surgically repair, and she just blacked out everything. She remembered going to the park in the morning, and that was it. And then she was home. Her mother, who is distraught and angry at herself for letting her child run loose like that, moves her away very quickly from the scene of where it took place. They go across the country, they change their names. And so she really has no connection to what happened to her. She just has this feeling that something went wrong when she was eight, and life has never been the same. And she's just been making mistake after mistake after mistake from that point forward. One of the mistakes she makes is she gets pregnant when she doesn't mean to, right out of school. And she has the baby, and the baby dies after a couple of days. And so she feels she made a mistake in getting pregnant, and now she made a mistake. She can't even be a mother. You know, she doesn't even deserve to be in the mother's club. The baby lived, you know, 3 or 4 days. All of that stuff came from my experience with children in Haiti, and the feeling that you have about protecting them, and if you can protect them. And of course, I had one little one who also died, you know, that I tried to protect. And I remember, you know, when she did die of a brain tumor, feeling like a failure. And even though everybody said, you know, it wasn't your fault, you don't create a brain tumor, all that, there's still part of you that says, I didn't protect this child, I felt like a failure. I translated a lot of that into this book.
Yeah, because the book follows a young woman whose life is also cut short. Was there a lot of overlap there in terms of the timing of it? When she passed away, were you still writing this book?
Chica, our little girl, passed away. Just, I had the kind of concept in my head.
Oh, yeah.
And I hadn't sat down to write anything. Truth be told, I wanted to write a book about Chica. I really wanted to write all these emotions were so full.
Really? A nonfiction book?
Nonfiction book, yeah. I just wanted to write what happened. And, you know, a lot of people around me said, you're not ready to do that yet. You know, you're a little raw, you're a little emotional. Maybe you need to wait and just get some perspective on it. And I said, well, I don't know what to do with all this emotion, though, you know. And I kind of deviated into this. Because heaven, when you lose somebody, heaven is a lot on your mind. It's not an accident that I wrote The Five People You Meet in Heaven after Maury died. You know,
That was the next book.
That was the next book. And you start to think about, okay, well, then where'd they go? And having spent all this time with Chica, I mean, every single day for 2 years, she didn't go off to school, she didn't do anything, she was with us as we tried to help her save her life. You do kind of wonder, well, where is she now and what would she be saying? I am actually writing the book about Chica now.
Oh, you are?
So, yes. So okay. I waited one book, and it probably was a good thing. I have a different, you know, a little bit of distance on it. But that's what led to The Next Person You Meet in Heaven.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Mitch Albom when we come back in just a minute. Folks, I've been a small business owner for many years now, and I've come to learn what every small business owner knows. When you're your own boss, you work a lot harder than you ever did working for anyone else. There are a million little things to keep on top of, from paperwork to payroll, when all you really want to do is focus on growing and improving your business. Whether you work in HR or have your own small or medium-sized business, you know how crazy it can be. Miles of spreadsheets, never-ending paperwork, and countless random employee issues, the stress is huge. Thankfully, Bamboo HR can help. Bamboo HR automates countless tasks and manages all your employee data in one place. That's right, e-signatures, onboarding paperwork, personnel reports, tracking everything from time off and training to company assets are all in one easy-to-use program that's accessible from anywhere. That way, you can focus on people, not processes and paperwork. And right now, Bamboo HR is giving our listeners a special extended free trial. That's right. Instead of their standard 7-day trial, you can try out Bamboo HR for a full 14 days. The only way to get this special offer is to go to bamboohr.com/kick. For this exclusive extended free trial, go to bamboohr.com/kick. Again, this is a limited offer only available to our listeners, so go to bamboohr.com/kick. One more time, that's bamboohr.com/kick. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today with its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! And now, back to the podcast.
This latest book is a sequel, as you mentioned. Is this the first time done a sequel?
Never got to do a sequel before. And
were you hesitant?
Well, to be honest, I mean, there weren't very many books besides The Five People You Meet in Heaven that lent themselves naturally to a sequel. Mm-hmm. You know, I joke around that I don't get to live in the Harry Potter world or the Jack Reacher world or wherever where you can say, okay, what are we going to have our people do next? That would be a lot of fun for me. I'd love to do that, but I just haven't. All my books have sort of started and ended. In many cases, somebody dies or something, so I can't really just do it again. Mm-hmm. And this one was the only one that I sort of left the door open, because The Five People You Meet in Heaven is the first stage of heaven. But I had a lot of people start asking me, so what's the second stage of heaven? Because everybody, of course, wants to know, as if I know. Yeah, I said, you do know that I'm not sure that this is the first stage, right? And so, you know, there was
this isn't Dante, right?
Yeah,
set number of levels.
No, I haven't even thought past the first one, to be honest. But, you know, and Eddie was a favorite character of mine. And so I thought, well, if there is a book to do a sequel to, whatever happened to Annie when she grew up? And I was fascinated by the idea of, and I guess it's tied in a little bit with Chica and all that, but how is your life different if you are saved from death? You know, like, are you eternally grateful? Do you live life totally differently? Or do you just kind of go on like, that was a little bump in the road, and I don't know, everyone else is making such a fuss of it, but to me, you're alive one day and you're alive the next day. So do you you just kind of get used to being
alive?
Yeah,
does it transform you?
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to kind of explore. And as it turned out in Annie's case, it did transform her, but in a way that's why I made her not able to remember it, because I said, so subliminally, she kind of knows that she was about to die and she didn't, but she doesn't know why and she doesn't remember how. How does that play on her? And in her case, it made her feel like guilty, like she had done something wrong, because of course, as she finds out in heaven, she gets to meet Eddie in heaven. That's the kind of the thing that everybody waits for in the book. Okay, so when are they going to see each other? And he gets to explain to her, no, here's why I'm here. I'm here because of you. And everything that she's felt in her life up to that point, the guilt, the mistakes, oh, now I understand, you know, you died because of me and I'm at fault. And this seems to confirm her worst fears, which is that she's at fault for everything bad that happened in her life. And he says to her, no, you don't understand. I needed to save you because of something that I did in my life. And we find out, if you read the first book, you know, that when he was in World War II, he killed a little girl unbeknownst to him. And his whole life, he ended up working at an amusement park, taking care of children. And that was sort of heaven or God's way of kind of saying, okay, you took a life, you need to protect lives here. And he died protecting a young life. And that kind of, that was his penance, that was his salvation, for what he had done. So she's saying, no, I ruined everything. And he said, no, you didn't ruin. You allowed me to reach my destiny. And this is how we all kind of fit together. One person's wrongs can lead to somebody else's rights. And that's kind of, you know, a crux of the book.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about how we interact with each other.
Yeah, and Eddie is such a great character. I'm so happy to see him revived in this next iteration. Eddie was, I think you mentioned, a World War II vet who worked at this amusement park, never thought he amounted to very much or his life had any meaning. I think I read at some point that this was based on your uncle, right?
Yes.
Tell us about him.
So I had an Uncle Eddie. He looked like, sounded like, acted like the character in the book. He talked like this. He used to wear beater T-shirts, you know, and he'd tuck them in during dinner time so it was formal wear, you know. And, you know, he's real muscular, one of those guys that you could, like, that when we were kids, we'd jump, one kid would jump on one arm, one kid would jump on the other, and he would lift us like weights. He fought in World War II. He once said to me, you know, I would say to him, did you kill anybody in World War II? And he was stationed over in the Philippines. He was in the thick of a lot of it. And he said, I don't know, I might have. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, what a terrible thing.
Yeah,
to go through life and not
know.
He was firing in the dark. He was shooting at night. You know, how do you know?
Yeah.
So he always thought he was a nobody. He always said, I've never been nowhere, that they didn't ship me with a rifle. You know, that was his travel consisted of being sent off to war. And I loved him. I just, you know, he's like Popeye as an uncle. But I could never get him to, you know, to feel worthwhile. And so I kind of wrote that first book for him and for people like him who just don't feel that they matter. And there's so many people out there who just feel my life is insignificant, and there's just no such thing as a nobody or insignificant. And then with Annie, she thinks her whole life is a mistake. And again, I try to prove when they meet together, there's no such thing as a mistake either. You know, everything that you do wrong will lead you to something. Hopefully, how to do right, it may lead you to more wrong, but it does something. It doesn't just sit there alone. It's an atom crashing against another atom, and something happens as a
reaction.
Result. Yeah, there's a reaction.
Yeah. Now, did it feel like a strangely full circle moment to go within the span of 20-something years from being with an old man at the end of his life to bring a child to America and being there at the end of a child dying at such a young age?
Well,
like that, and then writing about Bolt.
I did think about that because Chica, our little girl from Haiti, at the end, she was in a bed. She always slept in our bedroom. You know, the kids are used to be sleeping with 12 and 14 other kids, so there's no such thing as having their own room. That's scary to
Right.
them. So she always slept in our bedroom when she was able to walk and move about. And then when she lost her, you know, ambulatory abilities, I would have to carry her from place to place. And she slept in a little bed alongside ours, and we would sit alongside her for long times, stretches, and talk to her while she could still talk. And I did think, boy, you know, 20 years ago, and it was 20 years later to the year that Chica came to us. It was 20 years after I saw Maury, and I said, 20 years later, and I'm now sitting alongside another bed, learning as well, but I'm learning from a 7-year-old instead of a 78-year-old. I can't say honestly that gave me comfort. I wished I hadn't. I observed it like, this is kind of strange, but I wished that I had been the one who was lying in the bed and she was a 7-year-old learning from me. That's the natural order.
Sure.
I remember my mother once saying to me, I think the first time I ever saw somebody we knew, their child or their son or daughter died. And I noticed how everybody was so upset, different than any funeral that I had seen. I was, you know, probably a teenager. I said, why is this so bad? And my mother said, when you go out of order, there's no explaining it. You know, you can accept if your mother or your grandparents die. It's sad. It breaks your heart, but it makes some kind of sense. Mm. When you go out of order and you say, no, death skips a generation and goes the other. There's no rectifying it in your mind. You roll it over again and again. And all those things that you can say when an older person died, they had a good life. They lived a long time. You know, it was their time. At least they had their family around. They got to see their children grow up. But when we had to bury Chica, And I had to think, and my wife had to think, that she'll never get married, and she'll never have children, she'll never go to high school, and she'll never... There isn't any, you know, so it's a different... I'm, I kind of wish I didn't have that wisdom, I guess, or that experience.
Yeah, and yet I think it's in this new book that you say there's no such thing as too soon.
Yeah.
Because we don't know the grand plan. We don't know what's too soon or what's too early, whether it's too late.
You're
what's
so
what the
smart
right time to go
to
is.
Pick up on that. No one has picked up on that yet. You're the first person.
Really? But,
you know, sometimes you just put lines in that are just for you, and they're not... They're, it's not a trick. You're not trying to... You know, see if a reader can guess this. You just wrote it from your heart, and you say, well, it plays a part in the book, but that really is how I feel. And it's on the first page, and it or second page, and it says something along the lines of, you know, Annie died when she was just 3 months shy of her 31st birthday. You might say that that's too young for a life to end, but what is too young for a life? And then I point out that, you know, when she was 8, her life was saved by an old man. So perhaps she was already older than she was meant to be.
Right.
And that all comes from watching the 7-year-old, you know, pass away. And what is too young for a life? She had she had a great 7 years. I know that, except for the end. And there are 4-year-olds who go. There are 3 and 2, especially with this disease that she had, DIPG. We're always hearing stories about very, very young children. So what's too young for life? What's too old for life? I don't know.
Yeah, and I suppose maybe it's pointless trying to make sense of it.
Right.
Yeah, at least in this life or where we are right now.
That's why I write novels about heaven, to try to make sense of it.
Yeah, I mean, death and the afterlife are frequent themes in your books. Do you think about death a lot when you're not writing?
No, you know, the truth is that I don't really write about death. I'm not really fascinated with death. Mm-hmm. I like death as a mirror to life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I bristle when, you know, someone will try to quickly say, well, all your books about dying or death. And I said, well, not really. I mean, books about serial killers are about death, and they have page after page of gruesome beheadings and pulling hearts out through the chest, and they describe all kinds of ways. Mine is usually one person who dies. It usually takes up a half a page, and the whole rest of the book is some about life or about what was learned through
death
that.
It's the catalyst.
That's right. But I find that most people don't want to kind of examine the questions that I'm interested in examining unless they really realize that their time is running out.
Interesting.
You know, then all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute, maybe I do need to think about this because I, you know, I could die too. So it's like they always say, you know, no one on their deathbed said, I wish I had worked a couple of days longer.
Yeah.
But yet while we're healthy, we keep working, right? There's something that happens, and I learned that from Maury. There's something that happens when you are looking death in the eye that puts everything into perspective, and it changes all of your viewpoints. So I use death in all of my books, all of my novels, to try to say, okay, I got your attention. Now think about this. You know, now that you accept that we're all going to meet the same end, now, does this really matter? Does time matter? I wrote a book about time called The Timekeeper. Does faith matter? A book about faith called Have a Little Faith. You know, does being able to talk with somebody, I wrote a book, The First Phone Call from Heaven, about people who actually could make phone calls or thought they were getting phone calls from the deceased. And how does that change if you could actually still have someone in your life communicating with you that you thought you'd lost forever?
And that's kind of relevant because, you know, scientists say that we're getting fairly close to the point where we may be able to download or upload our consciousness to a computer and get some sort of facsimile of great grandpa or whatever that you can talk to and interact
talk to.
And do you want to do that?
Right.
You know, how does that interfere with the grieving process and moving on then?
That's an excellent question. You all saw those Superman movies when we were kids where he goes to the Fortress of Solitude and pulls up Marlon Brando, and we're going, how's Marlon Brando talking to him now when he's dead already, but yet he's talking to him in the present tense? He recorded every possible sentence that he would have to respond to him, and then they're playing it. How does it work?
Yeah.
We're fascinated by that.
Yeah, and is that a good thing?
I don't think so, by the way. I think that there's a reason that I wrote this in the book, The Timekeeper, about time. The reason that life is limited is to make every day precious.
Yeah.
You know, if we really did live forever, as we are attempting, you could spend 100 years as a thief and say, you know, I'll clean up after 100 years and I'll see what it's like to be a thief, and then I'll do this, whatever. And, you know, there'd be no consequence to any of your actions because you wouldn't be thinking, I need to spend my time doing this because this is what's important. Nothing would be important. Mm-hmm. Everything could be done. It would be like, you know, you'd be in a delicatessen your whole life. You could eat everything anywhere all the time. So how are you going to appreciate food? And I think it's that way about life. I think that's why it comes to an end, to help us appreciate when it doesn't.
Your books inspire and appeal to the better angels of our nature at a time when society seems to just be so divided, so insular, and neighbors are becoming enemies just because of things like politics, which in the grand scheme of life is so petty, so small, has so little real relevance to real life. Have you thought much about how we can dial down the anger and put politics in perspective again and focus on the things that truly matter?
Well, yes, I think about it all the time. And I think the answer is unlikely to occur. We need to unplug from the whole world and return a little bit more to our smaller worlds. I don't think we were designed to live in everybody else's moment at the exact same moment all over the planet. I just don't think we're programmed to handle that much information, but we keep trying to do it. We keep trying to tweet to the whole world, reach the whole world, go viral, be heard everywhere, be the biggest, be the, you know, the most. And I think that's why we're short-circuiting. We remind me of a machine that's just running too hot. Yes, we can process a lot of information, and yes, I'm sure some brain scientist will say that we have more capability than we realize, but, you know, there's capability, and then there's human development. It's a little bit like the space race, you know, when they were trying to, you know, they knew eventually they could break the sound barrier, but they didn't just do it overnight, you know.
Yeah.
Over time, they slowly, each plane went a little faster and a little, and we're trying to do it overnight. And I think it's why it's making, everything's louder than it should be, everything's angrier than it should be, because we're dialed into too many voices, too much stuff. We keep getting this whole notion of reporting on what the Twitterverse is saying. Now, as a journalist by trade, you know, that's so antithetical to me. It would have been like when I was covering a baseball game when I was younger, I'd go into the stands and find four people who say something and then write, this is how everybody's reacting,
because
I've got
backwards.
Four people's, it's like the event is what matters, not what everybody's saying about the event. And we live in a world where it's not an event unless people are saying something about the event. That's backwards to me. And so I don't know that, because everyone's so fascinated by it. Now, I predict, I probably won't live long enough to see it, but I predict that there will be a backlash to all of this. And at some point in the future, and not so far away, there'll be this whole movement away from, you know, I don't mean necessarily becoming hermits and living off the grid, but there will be a movement that will feel like living off the grid, because the grid will have its tentacles into us even more. And people will say, no, I found something better. It makes me feel better, because I think humans are designed to deal like you and I are sitting in a room together one-on-one talking. I'm not talking to 10 million people who I can see. I may be, you know, you may play this for 10 million, but right now it's just me and you.
Yeah.
And I think that that's how we are design, and I think that's how we can feel the actual emotions that we're supposed to feel. Because what you can't feel with 10 million people is empathy, which is a big part of this book,
which, by the way, that I wrote.
You know, and you can't feel those human emotions. Yeah. It's just a crowd, you know? And I think we're meant to experience empathy. I'm meant to look at your face and see if I see something in your eyes that makes me say, what's the matter? You know, I remember my, not to quote my mother too often, but she passed away in the last few years, so I find myself thinking about a lot of things she said. I could never teach her email. I tried over and over. I said, this great thing, email, look, I'd be able to. No, not interested. Finally, I said, Ma, you're smart. You know, you're not one of these people that says, I can't handle. Well, what's with this? I'm not learning how to do email. She says, if I start doing that, you'll stop calling me.
Good point.
And she was right. You know, so I had to keep calling her, had to keep visiting her if I wanted to talk to her, because she wanted to hear my voice. She said, if I read an email, I don't know if you're upset. I can't tell.
Yeah.
But if I hear your voice,
you
know, I'd say, hi, Mom, what's wrong? You know, I'd be like that. So
I'm sure she wasn't a big texter then.
No, she passed away before the texting.
Okay.
You know, I just think we're designed to be more human and more small spaced. So my answer would be, that, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, Mitch, this has been a real pleasure. Before we go, you probably get asked this all the time, but who do you think will be the first person that you meet in heaven, or who do you want to be the first person you meet in heaven, assuming your wife is still alive, let's say?
Well, want, think, imagine, these are different answers.
Sure.
For many years, I would answer that question, which I have been asked, by saying I certainly would want one of my, if I got five people, I'd want one of my five people to be Maury, mm-hmm. if only for the fact that I would, you know, he never got to read a word of Tuesdays with Maury.
That's right. He passed away before it hit the presses, huh?
And so of all the people who have read that book, who go on and on about him and tell me what they think of him and how wise he wasn't one of them. And so I would like to just ask him, you know, how do you think I did? Did I portray you all right? Did I, you know, was I honest and true to your message? You know, I hope I didn't embarrass you in any way. So yeah. These are so many questions that I would love to ask him. And I used to say, you know, okay, of all the big, you know, there's so many names out there. In recent, just the last 4 years, I lost my mom, I lost my dad, and I lost our little girl.
Wow.
And I can't now say that, you know, if you're going to give me one, I want it to be Maury. I want it to be a combination of those three
yeah.
people, and I especially want to hold our little girl again.
Yeah.
I held her. She used to say to me, when she couldn't walk anymore, you know, she lost the ability to walk, and I had to carry her from place to place. And one time we were coloring, which she adored doing, and I looked at my watch. I realized how late it was, and I had to get downtown for something. And I said, "Oh my gosh, Chica, I gotta go." And she said, "Why?" I said, "I have to work." And she said, "Mr. Mitch, I have to play." And I said, "Yeah, I know, Chica, but this is my job." And she put her crayon down and she said, "No, it isn't. Your job is carrying me," you know, like that. And, you know, because she was like that. But when I thought about it, I said, well, of course, my job is carrying her. It's all of our jobs to carry those who need us, mm-hmm. you know, more than any work we have. Why do we work? Most of us work to carry those who need us, you know, to put food in their mouths and help them, you know, and to have money for later on in life when they need help, and or our parents when they need help. So I did carry her for much of her life. And when she passed away, which was at our house, I carried her from our house outside for the last time to the, you know, to the hearses that awaited there to take her to the funeral home. And I remember that walk. I will always remember that walk, and I will always remember holding her. And I don't want that to be the last time I held her, you know, because she couldn't open her eyes at that point and you know, make fun of me or stick her tongue out or whatever she was going to do. And I imagine in heaven I will get a chance to do that again.
I certainly hope so. Mitch, you certainly make us think about the things that truly matter. Well, once again, Mitch Albom's latest book is The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. Mitch, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Mitch Albom for joining me on the podcast. Order his book, The Next Person You Meet in Heaven, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. For more on Mitch, visit MitchAlbom.com and follow him on Twitter at Mitch Albom. Folks, I was just telling you earlier how I got my day started with an espresso monster today. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.